This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
It is my great pleasure to introduce today's speaker, Peter Singer. Peter Singer is the Ira W. De Camp Professor of Bioethics at Princeton University and Laureate Professor in the School of Historical and Philosophical Studies at the University of Melbourne. The most prominent ethicist of our time, he is the author of more than 20 books, including Animal Liberation, Practical Ethics, and The Life You Can Save. His most recent book, The Most Good You Can Do, concerns effective altruism and will be the subject of today's lecture. Please join me in welcoming Peter Singer to the Wheeler Centre stage.
Thank you very much for that warm welcome. It's a pleasure to see you all here to hear about effective altruism. So let me start by jumping straight into this and saying, what is effective altruism? So effective altruism is both a philosophy and a social movement. Philosophy in the broad sense of the term, the sense of a philosophical outlook on life, a set of values that you take to life. And the idea of that is that you should be living your life so as to make the world a better place. That doesn't really mean that absolutely everything you do has to be directed towards making the world a better place. That would be a little too saintly for most of us, probably practically all of us. But it does mean that that should be something, a consideration that you think about during your life, that you make when you make important decisions, like choosing a career would be one example if you're at that stage of life, or what to do with some of your income, your money, that those decisions, that this plays a significant part in your life. So that's the altruistic part of it. The effective part of it is, it's not just a matter of making the world a better place, but of getting the most out of whatever you're doing to make the world a better place, getting the best value for that, so that, in effect, you could say you're trying to make the world the best place that you possibly can with those resources, time, money, whatever it is that you're doing for it. And this should be a very familiar notion if you think about you have some money that you want to spend, you need to buy, let's say, a new dishwasher. So you will look either online or some consumer magazine as to which dishwasher gives you the best value for money. You don't want to spend twice as much for a dishwasher that isn't as good as the cheaper one. But strangely, when it comes to philanthropy or charity, that kind of thinking stops. People just leave it. They think very little about which of the charities will be able to do the most, where they'd be able to have the biggest impact. So that's one of the things that effective altruism is saying. Try to get the best value for whatever you're contributing. And I'll say a little bit more about that in a moment. So that's what it's about. And this is, by the way, I should mention, a reasonably new movement. You see here a quote from a Wikipedia page. If you'd Googled effective altruism, I'd say as recently as 3 years ago, you would not have found a Wikipedia page. So basically, it didn't exist, right? If it didn't have a Wikipedia page. But now it does. In fact, you know, it's been building for maybe the last 10 years at the most, but certainly not longer than that. So what counts, though, you might say, as making the world a better place, improving the world? Obviously, that's where a whole lot of values will come in. And this slide tries to say something briefly about those values. Hard to say anything briefly that everybody in the effective altruism movement would necessarily agree with. But some of the key points are, firstly, that it takes a universal perspective. So it really takes seriously the idea that you're trying to make the world a better place. You're not just trying to make Melbourne a better place, for example, or Australia, or some other group to which you belong. You're actually thinking at a larger level, at a universal level about that. Then, okay, so what makes the world better? Well, again, you could get different views, but a kind of core set of values, which most people would agree, is that improving the well-being of the beings in the world, that is, reducing their suffering in particular, but also, insofar as you can, maybe increasing their happiness, their welfare, that those things make the world a better place. Then, reducing the incidence of premature death when children die from poverty-related causes, for example, that's a bad thing. And if you can prevent that happening, it's a bad thing because then those children can live lives of a more normal lifespan. Of course, it also reduces suffering. Parents grieve when their children die. Children suffer when they're ill. But the fact that you're saving lives clearly counts as well. Animal suffering matters, but there would be no real consensus in the movement as to how much it matters. I think everybody would agree it matters some. But one of the difficult questions, just to forestall you asking me, is how you balance the suffering of a large number of animals against perhaps a smaller number of human beings. Okay, then there are other principles that you might think of as morally important. Equality, justice, fairness, not violating certain moral rules. And EAs will generally appreciate the value of those principles. But some of them will say they're valuable because when you have societies that embody those principles, those societies have higher welfare. Generally, there's less suffering because people deal with each other on a level of equality, fairness, justice, and so on. Therefore, their value is really instrumental. Their value is in terms of the society they lead to. Other people, but I think probably a minority within the EA movement, will say, no, I think that they're intrinsically important, even if they don't lead to higher welfare. The other concept that I just want to get across from this slide is the idea that what you're trying to maximize really is expected value. That takes into account the fact that, generally speaking, we can't be certain about the consequences of what we're doing. So if you have, on the one hand, the possibility of, with a high degree of probability, saving one life, or the chance of saving 10 lives, but you know it may misfire and you may save no lives at all, how do you weigh that? Well, the idea of expected utility says if you can put a figure on the probabilities, you discount the value by the likelihood that it will be achieved. So if your chances of saving 10 lives, if you have, let's say, a 20% chance of saving 10 lives, that would have higher expected value than a certainty of saving one life, because you divide 10 by 20%, which is by 5, you get 2 lives. On the other hand, if it's a 10% chance of saving 10 lives, it comes out as the same as a certainty of saving one life. So that's how we think about things where we can't really know for sure whether we will or won't achieve the results we're trying to achieve. Okay, I want now to just tell you about some of the people who have played a key role in the movement. This is Toby Ord. He happens to be an Australian, although he's now living in Oxford. Toby was studying both mathematics and philosophy, got interested in philosophy and particularly interested in ethics. He was heading for an academic career and decided one day that he was thinking along these lines. I'm now a graduate student. I'm getting a graduate studentship. I think, let's say, it was £14,000 per year. And I'm living quite fine on that, you know. I don't really feel that I suffer greatly through not having more money than that. So suppose that I continued to live on that amount of money, even though, as my academic career progresses, I'm going to get paid more than that. How much surplus would I have, and how much good could I do with that surplus? So, to cut the story short, he calculated how much surplus he would have throughout his academic career until 65 or something like that, and then divided that sum by the cost of either preventing someone going blind, which can be done quite cheaply in respect of the largest single cause of preventable blindness, which is trachoma, which is not a cause of blindness in Australia, but is in developing countries, or restoring sight for someone who has cataracts, an operation that, of course, is very commonly performed here in Australia, but there's, I would guess, probably pretty much nobody in Australia who is blind because they have cataracts, because before they got to the stage of being completely blind, the cataracts would have been removed, you wouldn't, you know, whether you could afford that or not, you would have been able to get it at no charge. But there are millions of people in developing countries who are blind because of cataracts and can't afford to get it done. And there are organisations you can donate to. Fred Hollows Foundation is a famous Australian one, which will set up clinics where that operation can be performed. So Toby calculated that with the money that he would have to spare if he continued to live on something like his graduate studentship, he would be able to save the sight or restore the sight of 80,000 people. And he thought that was a very impressive figure. Yeah, you can think of the MCG full of almost full of people, and you could restore sight in all of them. Wouldn't that be a pretty incredible thing to do with your life? Well, Toby's figures showed that it's a perfectly possible thing to do with your life without being Bill Gates or anyone like it. So he thought that he ought to tell other people about this, and he set up a website called Giving What We Can, together with some others there, and founded an organization. And he himself, as this slide says, took a pledge to live on, he did somewhat increase the 14,000, or maybe that's just inflation adjusted, I'm not sure, took a pledge to live on something like that, I just put the thing at the bottom. You know, he's married. He's got a mortgage. He's not living in a cave or a barrel or anything like that. He's got a perfectly normal kind of lifestyle. On the website, Giving What We Can, he's encouraging people not to do what he's done, but something a little more modest, to pledge to give 10% of their income to effective charities. And he's provided information about which charities are highly effective. So Toby was a key figure, I think, in getting this movement going back in about 2007. Together with this man, Will McCaskill, who worked with Toby to found Giving What We Can, has a book coming out. It's not that I don't want you to buy mine, but there's another good book coming out in a few months called Doing Good Better that Will has written, which I think will contribute to the field. And he's also the founder of this other organization called 80,000 Hours. 80,000 Hours, I think it's just a coincidence that it's the same number that Toby calculated he could save the sight of. 80,000 Hours is Will's calculation of the number of hours that most people spend working on their careers. And he was struck by the fact that the decision as to what career you're going to have is not one that people spend a lot of time thinking about, despite the number of hours that they're going to spend with it. And in particular, if you were interested in choosing a career that would do the most good in the world, there's not a lot of discussion of that you find online either, and what you do find is pretty obvious sort of stuff, or seems obvious, but Will thought maybe is not even quite right. So, for example, you find advice saying you could work for a charity. You could work for Oxfam or some other NGO. You could become an aid worker, and you would do good that way. Or you could train if you can get into medical school and train in medicine, and you could become a doctor who performs these operations, removing cataracts, those sorts of things. And while they may be good things to do, Will had a different idea about it. Oh, here's the website, by the way, where you can go and have a look if you want to follow up, particularly if you are at that stage of thinking about future careers. But Will had the idea that maybe a career in something like finance or investment banking would be a way of making a big positive difference to the world. You might say, why on earth would he think that? Is he some kind of arch-conservative who thinks that Wall Street is the greatest benefactor of the world? Well, no, he's certainly not. But the thought is that if you want to be able to give more, you have to have more. Toby, as I say, calculated what he could give. Wasn't a huge sum because he's planning to be an academic. We academics are not that hugely paid. But if you did earn more, you would be able to give a lot more. And that could be a highly effective thing to do. So here's one of my former students at Princeton who is doing just that. Matt Wager was a very bright philosophy student at Princeton, could have gone on to graduate work. He was offered a place at the University of Oxford to do graduate work. But he decided, on the basis of arguments of the kind that Will and others have discussed, there was an active, effective altruism group around the Princeton area. He decided that he would go into finance, and because he had a bit of math in his background too, he was able to land a very well-paid position. And just a year after graduating, he was able to donate $100,000 to effective charities. Obviously, he didn't use his income, as many of the fellow Wall Street workers would have, to buy a Porsche or a bigger apartment or something like that. He's living modestly and donating a lot. And he's continued to do that. I actually saw him. His firm has now shifted him to Hong Kong, and I gave some lectures there just last week and had lunch with him. He's continuing to do that, and he's pretty happy with his career choice, and he's not showing any signs of being corrupted by the lifestyle of the other people in the office that he's working with. Now, you might still say, well, how do you decide that this is actually a better thing to do than becoming an aid worker for Oxfam? Will's argument is like this. If you become an aid worker for Oxfam, you're taking a job that if you had not taken, somebody else would have. Right? There's no real great shortage of candidates for those sorts of jobs. So the good that you will do is not everything that you do. It's only the extent to which you can do the job better than the second best candidate in the field who did not get the job because you took it. And probably that's going to be a relatively marginal difference. In fact, might be no difference at all. Oxfam might have made a mistake in appointing you. The second candidate might have been better. But assume that they know what they're doing. You were the best candidate, but only by a modest amount. Now, there's one sense in which the same applies to the job that Matt took, and there's another sense in which it doesn't. The sense in which it applies is that if the firm that appointed him, if he'd not taken the job with the firm that appointed him, there was another candidate in that field who would have done almost as good a job for the firm as he did. But that's not what we're interested in. What we're interested in is, would that person have made as big a positive difference to the world? And it's very unlikely that that person would have donated to effective charities as Matt is doing. So the most probable outcome is that none of that money that Matt is giving to those effective charities would have gone to those effective charities. So in that sense, it's not replaced by the second best candidate, and all of the good that those donations do is, in a sense, to Matt's credit. And the amount of money he's giving is such that Oxfam could easily appoint a completely new aid worker, perhaps two new aid workers. And then all of the good that those aid workers did would be attributable to the donations that Matt had made. So that's the argument for saying that if you have the kind of character for it, firstly, if you have the ability to get that sort of job, which not everybody does, and secondly, if you have the kind of character that can work well at it and not be corrupted by the lifestyle of your colleagues, that could be a very good thing to do. But you don't have to do that. There's lots of people who are in this effective altruism movement who are giving quite a lot. Here's Julia Wise, who's a social worker, rather different sort of occupation. But the reason that she's an effective altruist is that she and her partner are giving a lot of their income. And even when their income was very modest, when it was essentially, I think, Julia's pay, they were still giving a third of their income, which was quite impressive at that level. Now their income has increased because Jeff has a better job, so they're giving half of what they earn. So that's another option. And if you're interested in this, Julia has an engagingly written blog called givinggladly.com, where she talks about her lifestyle, how much she enjoys what she's doing, and ways to be able to live economically and still and give a lot. Okay, I want to say a little bit now about how this movement has the potential to change philanthropy and how we should think differently about philanthropy and charity. And this is the idea of how you choose the cause that you should give to. Now, traditionally in philanthropy, there's a view that essentially any kind of cause is a good cause if you're passionate about it, if it's what you want to do. So here's, I've gone to the website of one of the biggest philanthropy advisors in the United States, Rockefeller Philanthropy Advisors, and they have quite a lot of information online about, you know, what you should do if you're thinking about becoming a philanthropist or if you have money you want to give away, basically. They have a number of little booklets, again, online. This one is called Finding Your Focus in Philanthropy. This is the one I want to pick on because it makes this claim. What is the most urgent issue? There's obviously no objective answer to that question. Now, I think there's actually two mistakes in this. One is a small one and one is a larger one. The small one is the use of the word urgent. I think what they really mean in the context is this one issue which it's more important to give to than other issues? Because urgency obviously might be related to a particular situation. It may be very urgent to give to relief of the victims of the earthquake in Nepal, because if they don't get food and shelter, they may die. But whether that is the most important cause, how that compares with, for example, distributing bed nets to prevent malaria, which in one sense is not so urgent, there's no immediate crisis, but perhaps it actually offers better value for your charitable dollar than giving to earthquake victims. That, at least, is an open question. So I don't think you should ask what's the most urgent issue. But either way, the really important point is that there's a kind of idea that there's no way of judging between different causes here, that it's all subjective, that it's all a matter of what you care about, following your passion, and so on. And so things like this sort of choice, which they talk about, these examples in their website, are just subjective. So on the one hand, Ted Turner, back in the late 90s, gave $1 billion to the United Nations to scale up already proven health programs that reduce the incidence of children dying from preventable diseases like malaria, measles, diarrhea, and so on. That's one thing you could give to. And the other it talks about is a gift by Lucille Packard of a new children's hospital for Palo Alto. Palo Alto is in Silicon Valley, where Stanford University is. It ranks as the third wealthiest community in the United States. If you set up a hospital there, you're not going to be saving lives for anything like the cost of Ted Turner's program, which I didn't mention, said down the bottom here, maybe as low as $80 per life saved. I think it's probably not that anymore now. It may have been when it started, but obviously you try to pick the low-hanging fruit. You work in areas where the diseases that you can cure are most prevalent, and therefore you have low costs per life saved. Once you've immunized all the kids against measles in that area or distributed the bed nets in that area, it may get more expensive per life saved. But it's still going to be far lower than spending between $1 and $2 million to separate a pair of conjoined twins. So, if there's no objective answer to this question, then, you know, you can do either. They're each just as good as the other, and that seems to be the attitude that RPA takes when they discuss them. That seems to me to be clearly wrong. We ought to be getting the best value from what we're giving, and setting up a hospital in one of the wealthiest communities of one of the wealthiest countries in the world isn't going to be the way to get the best value. And here's another way that isn't the way to get the best value. This is just this is not in the book because it just happened last month, I think. Giving $100 million to the Lincoln Center in New York, which, as many of you probably already know, is the premier centre for classical music, opera, concerts and so on, giving $100 million towards the cost of renovating. That's not the full cost, according to Lincoln Centre, of renovating what used to be known as Avery Fisher Hall, but is now going to be known as, you guessed it, David Geffen Hall. So you could say it's not entirely altruistic either, but apart from that, it just doesn't seem to me that spending hundreds of millions of dollars to renovate a concert hall for wealthy Manhattanites and tourists who get to go there is the best possible use of your money in a world which has still, unfortunately, millions of children dying of preventable poverty-related diseases. There are more urgent, better things to do with your money. And just let me add, since perhaps some of you are saying, oh, well, but does this aid really work, that the kind of thing that Ted Turner gave to really does work. The number of kids dying from preventable diseases has dropped quite steeply since then. In fact, and it's still dropping. One of the books that's being sold at the back, one of my earlier books, The Life You Can Save, was published in 2009. I'm not sure, maybe that edition was a year or two later and maybe I changed the figures, but in 2009, when I did the first edition of the book, I used the latest UNICEF figures for the number of children dying before their fifth birthday, and it was 9.8 million. In the new book, or the current figures, the latest figure now, is 6.3 million. So, you know, that's we've cut it by a third in something like 6 or 7 years. That's pretty impressive progress. That's saving 3.5 million lives every year over the rate that it was 7 or 8 years ago. And that's despite the fact that the world's population has continued to increase, and therefore it's a smaller proportion of all the world's children than it used to be. Okay, this is the comparison. This is just a comparison with what Geffen is giving. This is a trachoma clinic treating these children for trachoma, which is a disease that actually gets in their eyes. It's a microorganism that gets in their eyes when they're quite young and very slowly develops and blurs their vision over maybe 15 or 20 years, and then it takes a few more years till they actually go blind. But a very inexpensive treatment can prevent that happening. As I say, the cost is something like $25 to $100. If it's $100, then there's 1 million children whose sight you could have preserved for the cost of just David Geffen's portion of the renovation of the concert hall. Now, some people will say that, well, why shouldn't you do both? Why shouldn't you renovate concert halls and help people in poverty-stricken countries, or donate to the arts and help people prevent blindness. And this is an example of this. Nicholas Kristof, who's a columnist for the New York Times, wrote about my book and about Matt Waga, the person I just showed you, in the New York Times earlier this month. And one of the online comments was exactly this kind of attitude, which I've had a few times, so that's why I put it on this slide. What about improving all areas of human experience? Playing off one area that needs more money versus another is a false choice. Both arts and treatment of human illnesses are worthy of support. Is it a false choice? If anyone will show me how I can donate whatever it is I'm prepared to spare from what I use to live on to the arts and also donate the same sum to treating human illnesses, I'd like to know how to do that. But it seems to me that we have finite resources and we do face a real choice. Whatever it is that we think we don't need, that we're prepared to donate to charities, we can give all of that to the most effective cause, the cause that does the most good, or we can give less than all of it to the most effective cause, giving some of it to a less effective cause. And the result of that will be that we will do less good with the amount that we're donating. So, unfortunately, I think we do face a real choice. I don't see a way out of that. Okay, I do want to make sure you have time for questions, so I'm just going to say a couple of brief things about this and then I'm going to stop. If you want to know which individual organisations are highly effective, there's a couple of websites that do research into this. And this is the most rigorous of them, GiveWell, givewell.org. It's a US site. You may not find a lot of Australian charities on it. But it's set the standard for rigorous evaluation. And it's, again, one of the reasons why effective altruism has emerged in the last 10 years. It didn't exist 10 years ago. It would have been much harder to know which charities were effective without the existence of GiveWell. And secondly, this is an organization that spun off the book I mentioned earlier, The Life You Can Save, and it also now has a set of rankings which I have more involvement in. I don't do all the research for it, but I do discuss it with others who do, and you can find a couple of Australian organizations on that list. So I'm going to pause at that point to make sure that we do have time for questions. So thank you very much for your attention. I look forward to your questions.
We've got some hands raised.
Hi, Peter. I'm Rachel. Firstly, I just wanted to say thank you. Regarding trachoma, it's brought up some issues for me that then carried on throughout your speech, because we do have trachoma in Australia, in Central Australia.
Oh, right, okay.
And so it's brought up this is a numbers game, and I'm a midwife, and I've worked in Central Australia and I've worked in African and Asian countries. Central Australia, Indigenous populations, very small numbers of births, but it's important that those births are well and those families are well, etc. So people that you could say are endangered almost, versus an African context, say Tanzania, where millions of people are suffering and dying. Both of those I've worked in. I just wondered if you had any thoughts about the numbers game and the low resource, high resource, low population, remote areas. Thank you.
Thanks very much for the thoughtful question. I think like most people in the effective altruism movement, I am strongly influenced by numbers. So I would normally go where you can help the greatest number of people. But let me say something else about the trachoma in Central Australia, which, you know, you're right, I should have thought of. I think that's a case where, you know, we are a wealthy nation. We have a government that provides health services to us. I think that's a case where we ought to be activist citizens. We ought to be pressuring the government into doing its job properly so that we don't have cases of trachoma in Australia and we don't have some of those problems with other problems with illness, life-shortening illnesses that affect Indigenous people much more than they do other people in Australia. So certainly if somebody says, I want to spend some time doing that, I want to make that part of my activist life, getting the Australian government to do more on those things, that would seem a very worthwhile use of your time. I don't know that it's necessary to donate financially to that, to the way that it is to, say, Fred Hollows or other organisations and the work they're doing in that field.
Hi, yeah, just a comment to begin. Having worked in the industry that Matt Wager works in, I assume he's actually... even though, look, good on him for what he's doing, I assume he's making a lot of unethical decisions actually at work. So his actual work itself will actually involve a huge number, and he can't be a trader without making, I would have thought, some level of unethical decisions in his day-to-day work. So he can't do it. He can't generate the income without making unethical decisions, would be my first point. And just the second one, even though you, in the beginning, you talked about the value placed on animals, it does strike me that there's a lot of the discussion is very anthropocentric about, you know, what's the cost of a human life saved, whereas inevitably I would have thought saving more humans leads to a loss of biodiversity amongst non-human species. And how do you deal with that?
Yeah, as I said, that's a very difficult question to try to compare saving the lives of non-human animals and are we only talking about species that are endangered, because of course by far the largest number of non-human lives that we take are the lives of the animals we eat, not the lives of the endangered wild species. So how do you weigh those things up? That's really difficult, and I don't think anybody's got a good hold of that. And I think perhaps that is one issue in which, at the moment, you do have to say, well, think about this yourself, come to some sort of conclusion, and then you will decide whether you're going to put money into trying to persuade more people to become vegan, for example, so there are fewer animals slaughtered, and incidentally, there's also fewer greenhouse gases going into the atmosphere, which is another good thing. Or are you going to, you know, put your effort into saving human lives, or maybe you're going to focus on saving endangered species? So, in a way, I'm still putting that in the too hard basket. About Matt and ethical decisions, two things to say. One is, you know, he's doing arbitrage trading, and his view is that mostly that isn't having any really major ethical impact. I see you shaking your head. So, you know, he thinks it's basically smoothing out price jumps that would otherwise occur. Maybe he's wrong about that. Let's assume that he is wrong about that. You still have to ask the question, would the situation have been better if he hadn't taken that job? Right? Because, as I said, somebody else would have taken that job. Now, Matt, you know, clearly does think about ethical issues. Probably he thinks more about ethical issues than the next candidate in the field. So if he was aware of something really egregious that his firm was doing or he was being asked to do, I think he would go to the seniors in the firm and say, look, do we really have to do this? Isn't this crossing a line? You know, maybe it could be bad publicity even for the firm if that's the only way to appeal to the people higher up. Whereas somebody else might not do it. So I don't see it as a reason why he shouldn't have gone into that company. I do agree that there might be a point at which, you know, he might need to say, I can't do this anymore because I've talked to the people higher up, they're not listening to me, I just think what the firm is doing is wrong and I don't want to be part of it. If he gets to that point, he'll still be in a position to actually make a difference because he can then be a whistleblower on it in a way that if he'd never been on the inside, he would never have even known about it.
Hello, Peter. A slight variant of that. Suppose I had a really great income and I could reduce my tax dramatically, as some rich people seem
We've
to manage to do.
We've just been reading about that, yes.
Yes. And I could effectively direct my money then to a much better cause than our government seems to be able to do. Would that be ethical?
It's a really interesting question. Of course, one of the things you can do by donating, you reduce your tax anyway if you're donating to a tax deductible charity, and that's one of the reasons why, as I mentioned, this website does have a couple of Australian charities on it, whereas GiveWell doesn't, so you won't be able to get tax deductions for the US ones. But you're obviously suggesting something a little bit more than just taking the legitimate charitable tax deduction. Look, I think that, you know, it's important that people should have an ethos of paying their taxes in the community. You could argue in this case you're doing it for a good purpose, you're trying to have more money to give to good causes, but I can't really condone tax cheating. I think that we should all be playing a role in supporting the institutions of a community, you know, many of which do good things, as we've been saying, some of which don't do such good things, but I think that you know, we ought to see that as something that is an obligation, and within what that allows in terms of what the law allows, and in terms of not being as creative as some people seem to manage to be in terms of minimising their tax deduction, we ought to pay our taxes and then see what we have left over for good causes.
We have one up the back here.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm just wondering how effective altruism deals with future risks, say by those posed by climate change, and spending your charity dollars now for something on something whose impact isn't going to be possible, probably, to measure for at least a little while.
Yeah. So the theoretical part of that answer is quite easy. Effective altruism does not discount the future merely because it's future. So those of you who know about economics will know that some economists actually do discount the future merely because it's future. They claim that this is what most people do, you know, social behaviour studies, that people seem to care less about the future, will put less weight on the future, and therefore some of those studies of climate change, there's a Yale economist called William Nordhaus, for example, actually discounted by a fixed percentage each year, and when you do that, if you project out 100 years, you find that the more disastrous effects of climate change that are predicted for that time get very little weight. Effective altruists typically will think that that's wrong, that future well-being counts just as much as present well-being, but they will acknowledge, as I said before, the discount for uncertainty. So we have to be able to predict what difference it will make if we do certain things. And with climate change, we do have some predictions. I mean, we have the predictions from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's assessment report, which says, you know, what consequences are probable. It even puts figures on them, or puts a range of figures on them, 95%, 90%, and so on. So on that basis, if you want to rely on those figures, you could say that will give us the indication, and that will give us how bad this is. And then the next question is, how confident can we be that what we might do in that, to that cause will make a difference? And I think that's probably where the problem comes in there, because really what we need to do to make a difference is to get governments, particularly I'd say the United States government, but obviously Australia can set an example. It looked for a little while as if Australia was setting an example until that was undone by our present government. So, you know, how likely is it that we're going to make a difference to how bad the consequences of climate change are in 50 or 100 years? And that's the more difficult calculation. But if you want to do that, if you want to say, well, yes, the chances that we can make a difference or that my actions can make a difference are very, very small, but the consequences are so disastrous on such a large scale that even a very, very small chance of making a difference to such a big, disastrous outcome is worth doing. I think that that's a perfectly reasonable course to take. I'm not going to try and persuade you that you should do the smaller things that you can do here and now with a higher degree of certainty. I think both are reasonable strategies.
Unfortunately, we have time for one more question.
Thank you. Thank you for your time today. I guess this is just my own curiosity and a personal question for you. How much of your income or what percentage do you give, and to which charities do you personally donate to?
Okay, good. I'm not as saintly as Toby is, I have to say. I don't live on a fixed income like that, but I give about a third of what I earn to charities, so I'm lagging a little bit behind Julia Wise and Jeff Kaufman as well. You know, it's a little hard to defend any particular figure. I think I should probably be doing more. I hope I will be doing more when, as I get more, if you like, you know, free cash that I can donate. At the moment, a lot of it is tied up in things. But I think that people find their own, you know, find what they're comfortable with, and then try and do better next year. And so that's the stage that I'm at. Which charities? I do donate to Oxfam as one of the charities that I've been donating to. Have been doing so for many years. I also donate to charities on the list here. So I have been donating to the Against Malaria Foundation, which is the top-rated organisation in terms of distributing bed nets against malaria. I've also donated directly to GiveWell because I think the research that they do is important in trying to help other people to donate. So that's a kind of, you know, at a higher level, if you like. If I can donate to them and they can use that money to influence several times that amount to go to effective charities, I think that that's a useful thing to be doing. I do also donate to some animal charities. I should have mentioned that for those interested in animal charities, there's a website, though again it's an American one, that tries to do for animal charities what GiveWell does for poverty-related human charities. It tries to evaluate them. It's much smaller than GiveWell, and it hasn't been going as long, but it's called Animal Charity Evaluators. So you can Google that, and you'll find them. And I give to one of their top-ranked charities, which is called Mercy for Animals. It's a US charity. I'm a US taxpayer, so it makes sense for me. It would probably make more sense for you if you're interested in animal welfare to give to Australian organisations. And when I was in Australia, I have supported Animals Australia, which I think is my guess as the most effective of the animal charities in Australia.
Please join me in thanking Peter Singer for today's lecture.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.